following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. This is the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. Yeah! The remedy for boredom has arrived. It's Friday.
It's Friday, gotta get down on Friday.
And we're going to have a great, great show today. We got Natty Neidhart here from the illustrious Hart family dynasty, an amazing lineage of fine pro wrestlers from Stu Hart, her grandfather, all the way up till today. Natty is also one of the stars of Total Divas on E. We're going to get to it. But first, love it. I love having that song play. What did you think of Gordy Canuck that was on the show last week or on Wednesday? He was a fine friend of mine. Maybe we'll hear from him again soon. Maybe Cosby will be back. Maybe Oates' mustache will come back. Maybe Katy Perry's boobs will make another appearance. You want to have some of my special guests? You want to let me know if you want to hear them again? Send me a note at Talk Is Jericho on the Twitter. Twitter. I love that name. Twitter. Sounds fun. What's going on this week? Guys, having a good day, Jerichoholics, huh? Question I get asked quite a bit. Chris, why are you so damn cool? And where did you get those light-up jackets that you wore in the WWE? And where can I get one? And it makes me laugh when people say, well, how come they don't sell those Jericho flashing light jackets at the merch stand? You know why? Because it cost $9,000 for the first one. Yeah, $9,000. That's a niner. That's why they don't sell them at the merch stands. They'd sell one every 5 years if we went to see like the Sultan of Arabia or something. Maybe he could afford one. My idea was when I came back to the WWE back in 2012, it was the big secret, the Save Us promos. It wasn't the Save Us promos. No, it was the End of the World as We Know It promos. And I wanted to have a totally different look from the suit and tie thing that I'd been doing the years prior. So I saw, and I didn't know what I wanted. I saw this jacket that Alice Cooper had on that had studs all on the sleeves. And I saw this, when Metallica did the MTV Icon, James Hetfield was wearing like these really cool leather pants. It was called distressed leather. So I didn't know where to find a studded jacket or a distressed leather. So I Googled distressed leather, Los Angeles. This guy's name popped up, Jonathan Logan, in the fashion district in downtown L.A. So I just gave him a call. I had to send him an email to get an appointment to get a call. It's like kind of one of those type of places. So I got a call. I told him what I wanted. He's like, well, you know, I got a couple other things I need to work on. I'll get back to you. So I waited. He got back to me about a week later. And he's like, well, we need to talk. And I said, listen, I'm going to be in L.A. I'll come into your studio and we'll shoot the breeze, see what's up. So I go down to the fashion district. I go upstairs, you know, five floors up. I go into this big warehouse. And there he is, Jonathan Logan. We start talking, and I give him some ideas, and we're looking through a few pictures that I downloaded, and he's like, well, I got to finish up this project I'm working on, and then we can go get together on it. So who are you working on by chance? And he's like, well, I'm doing all of Justin Bieber's stuff for his new tour. I was like, wow, okay. And then he says, yeah, and I'm also finishing up a couple things for David Lee Roth for the Van Halen tour. And that was like so crazy because when I was starting out in wrestling, I wanted to be the David Lee Roth of wrestling, like the ultimate front man, party host. Hey, what's going on? So now I'm having my gear made by the same guy that's making David Lee Roth stuff and Justin Bieber stuff, which, you know, say what you want about the Biebs. He's still, you know, a massively huge star. And if someone's making his gear, you know, the guy is good. And then I found out that the guy also makes all the Brad Pitt stuff. For when he does movies, like, you know, anytime Brad has like a leather jacket in Fight Club or World War Z, it's made by this guy, Jonathan. So we sat down and talked, and I mentioned, you know, this distressed leather, and I got this jacket with the studs. And so he's like, well, I can put together this and this. And he's kind of showing me a few of his things, and I see this this clip of Alicia Keys had just done a DJing set, and he had made a jacket for her that had like three blinking lights on each boob, I guess you'd say, each part of the chest, the female anatomy. And I said, wow, that's really cool. I said, but can you make those lights? Can you make like 100 of those lights? He goes, I can make 1,000 of them. I said, okay, well, let's do it. So that's kind of how the whole lighted jacket started. He put the lights all in the studded sleeve, and he put it all on the front and in the back. And, you know, when I came back, that's when you saw the jacket for the first time. And everyone's like, oh, Jericho's got this light-up jacket, and it's so exciting. And, of course, the first time I go to the ring, I hop in the ring, and I wave my arm around, and the one side of the lights goes dead right off the bat. I walk back in through the curtain, and Vince is like, wow, that was rotten. Your lights went out already. Ha, ho, ho, ho. And him and Hunter are laughing at me. Hee, hee, hee. And I was like, I shall destroy you bastards. But anyways, I could send it back to Jonathan. He rewired it. And because this jacket had never been done before, it's something that had never been done before, this lighted jacket. That's my Lars Ulrich impression. I wore a lighted jacket to the ring, and no one had ever seen anything like it before. It's crazy. So the wires were really thin. There were so many wires. Like if you looked in the lining of this jacket, it looked like the back of a computer or something like that. Just wires and circuits and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So the wires got fixed. They were really thin. Like I said, it was a prototype, so we'd never really seen anything like this before. It wasn't really made to be jumped up and down. It was made more like you put it on a mannequin and look at it. So constantly was breaking down, but I had the WWE kind of special effects guys on the case, and they were fixing it. They knew they would have to not weld it together, but you know, when you have a heat and you have some solder it, they'd have to solder it together. So they were fixing it. It would work, and it was fine. And then it was time for WrestleMania. I said, listen, I need a better jacket. So I called Jonathan up again. I said, you know, how many lights that last jacket have? He said, 1,000. I said, I want one with 2,000. He's like, okay. And that's where the second one came in, the red and black and blue one. So I have it in the backstage area of the Miami Enormo Dome, and I'm checking it out. It works really cool, and it's got a remote control that can go to different speeds, and it's just really super rad. I'm messing around. I come back in the dressing room. Everyone's looking at me and laughing. I'm like, what are you laughing at me for? What are you laughing at me for? And finally, someone shows me a camera that Christian and Brodus Clay were walking around wearing my jacket. You know, and for Christian, it's like a broom with a jacket on it. He's so skinny. And Brodus Clay was literally fat guy in little coat, you know. So my jacket still worked. It was fine. I get in the golf cart, go all the way around the stadium, go up through the gorilla position to where I'm waiting to go out for my match. The package plays, you know, the video package of the buildup, and it's exciting. And just as my music's about to start, I decide to click my jacket one more time to see if it works, and the entire right-hand side is not working. So I'm like freaking out, like, you got to be kidding me. And this jacket costs $15,000. Okay. Now you might say that's a lot of money, but I'm going under the 1978 Kiss principle that, you know, you got to spend money to make money. I'm sure those Kiss costumes cost a lot of money too, but the fact that they're iconic, people are, you know, still talking about them to this day. So it was worth it. So I'm waiting in gorilla position. The whole side of my jacket is out, and it's time for me to go to the ring. And now I'm not even thinking about my match. It's a title match against CM Punk. I'm not even worried about it. All I'm caring about is that my stupid jacket's not working. So I'm walking to the ring kind of like with my shoulder turned to the camera so that all you can see is the lights flashing and kind of hiding the non-light area. And because all I'm thinking too is I don't want Vince to be laughing at me again. Like, oh, your jacket doesn't work. And I'm like, screw him. There's no way I'm going to let him be laughing at me. So I'm walking to the ring, you know, kind of side first, like as if I'm Bela Lugosi with a cape in front of my face or something like that. Pull the strings. Pull the strings. So I walk down all the way. It's like a 100-foot walk. I get into the ring, and now I'm facing the hard camera, which is the camera that's like across the ring. It's on a tripod. And I'm just standing there like I'm doing some kind of a, you know, like a waltz or some kind of a Venetian, you know, something, whatever. My shoulder's facing the camera and the dead part of the jacket's facing away. And no one has noticed, thankfully, except for me. I was so angry. I was so, so angry. But then finally CM Punk's music played, and I'd never been so happy to hear, you know, the Cult of Personality in my life, because now I could take my stupid jacket off. And nobody noticed that it wasn't working. But if you go back and watch the video, you will see that the jacket does not work. And I went to the back and I flipped out. I called Jonathan Lowe. I want a refund. I want restitution. I want, you know, some money back. And of course I never got anything back, but it, you know, once we fixed it, cause it was a prototype, it became another great part of like kind of the Jericho pantheon, the Jericho legend. And I think at this point in time, I could just go put that jacket in the middle of the ring on a mannequin, turn it on and let people go, ooh, and just walk to the back and collect my check. I don't think people care about Jericho anymore. I don't think they care about Y2J anymore. They just care about the stupid jackets. So there you go. You got an extra 15 grand? You too can own a lighted jacket. All right. See, stuff like that you're only going to hear on Talk is Jericho. All right, Natty Neidhart is coming up. Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. On the line, one of the members of the most famous family in wrestling history. We talked to her uncle Brett a few weeks ago, and now we have Natty Neidhart here on the line speaking live from the set of Total Divas. How are you doing, Nat?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on, Chris.
Sorry, yeah, it's funny because I know you as Natty, so I officially have to call you Natalia. So Natalia is here on the line.
Yes, that is Natalia. And, you know, everybody just calls me Natty anyway. Like, it's funny because my name, you know, in WWE is Natalia, but everybody just calls me Natty. So I like Natty. It's better. It suits me.
It's more, yeah, it's more homey. Natalia sounds like you're Russian or something.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I need to be Russian, I can be Russian.
But sounds like a Smith Hart gimmick. Natty, we need you to be a Russian now. You're going to turn on the family and become Russian.
I know. I'm going to, well, that's, you know, speaking of Smith Hart, I actually, it's funny that I'm related to Smith Hart because that scares me in general. But but yeah, Smith would probably have me. If Smith ran a wrestling promotion, or, you know, if he was running, let's just say Stampede Wrestling, I would probably be doing some crazy off the wall weird wrestling, you know, weird Russian character that, you know.
Well, exactly, yeah. Because I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that's the funny thing about the Harts is there's so many crazy stories from your family, so many tales and. Legends, if you will, coming from your grandfather to your Uncle Brett and your Uncle Owen and Uncle Smith. Like a lot of crazy characters in your family, including your father, too, Jim the Anvil Neidhart. So you pretty much had no chance when you were growing up. You were going to be a wrestler no matter what and a very charismatic character yourself. How was that kind of growing up in the Hart Neidhart household?
You know, I always try to be very guarded as far as talking about the family and, like, interviews. And it's always like, it was awesome. It was cool. There was never a dull moment, you know. But, like, if people really, really, really knew what it was like, I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it's, we have so many unique characters in our family. You know, everybody from my Uncle Smith and Bruce. And, I mean, you go down the list of names. Like, you know, everybody knows Brett and Owen. But
right.
When you think about all the other characters, it's like, there's just so many that they, I can't even explain the lunacy that goes on in the Hart house. And when my grandfather actually had the Hart house in Calgary, I mean, it was totally normal for him to have 15 broken down Cadillacs outside of the, you know, outside of the house, you know, two or three wrestling rings set up on the lawn. You know, he actually made the wrestling rings, like he had designed them, and he had a welding shop at the back of the house that, you know, where the rings were actually built. And
oh, Stu actually built the rings?
Stu actually, he didn't build them, he designed them.
Oh, wow.
He had a welder that he hired back in the 70s, 80s, that like would weld the rings and put them together. So Stu's rings were different than everybody else's rings. They were bigger. They were like, from what I understand, they were like 20 by 20 or whatever. I don't know.
Oh,
how
wow.
That, yeah, they were big rings. So you definitely get your conditioning in. But like my grandfather, you know, he came from a different, you know, era where he was really, well, he was dirt poor growing up. He lived in a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's been talked about when he, you know, he had his book and everything, talked about living in a tent with dogs. But because of his background, you know, certain things were really important to him, like family and tradition and dinners. And I remember, like, one of the biggest, most offensive things my grandfather would be if you didn't finish your dinner or your plate. But my grandfather would also, like, save food. And there's those old stories. People talk about the spatula, like how, you know, they'd use it for cleaning up cat poop. And then And I don't want to confirm or deny those stories.
Yeah, that was always the story that Stu would have a big dinner for the wrestlers, and he'd be making eggs or something with a spatula, and then also, you know, finish up the eggs and then take some cat poop off the floor and throw it away using the same spatula. So you can't confirm or deny that verity of that.
I can't confirm or deny because in my grandfather's house, like I said, the family and food and, you know, it was like Grand Central Station. So everybody was always congregating in the kitchen, and it wasn't abnormal to have a cat or five cats on the counter while you're pouring your coffee or making your, and the cats ran the house. So my grandfather, you know, when people tell that story about the spatula and the poop and the, my grandfather using the spatula to flip the eggs, that would be normal in that house because that's something that would normally, like, even in the dungeon, people, Chris, you don't realize how dirty those mats were. I don't think that mat was ever changed since 1950, and I'm not even kidding.
Well, what's funny, too, is that a lot of people hear about the legend of the dungeon, and, you know, I trained there, too, and I couldn't believe, first of all, how small the dungeon was when you first went down there. Literally, it was more like it could have been called the furnace room because that's basically what it was. It was a very small room with a little ring that was about, I don't know, 3 inches off the ground, and there was pipes everywhere and furnaces everywhere. So you're saying that it was never, the canvas was never washed on the ring?
I don't think it was. I don't recall ever. Like, I don't think anybody ever really changed it. So there was holes in the walls, and like the room next to the dungeon actually was a crematorium. So right next to, so my grandfather's house was a hospital in the First World War. So that dungeon actually was the room next to the dungeon is a crematorium. It's crazy. So that made it even more spooky. Oh, yeah. And then people's heads have gone through the ceiling, and there was, you know, my grandfather had an old pit bull that would poop on the mat. They would just clean it up, and everybody would just go about their business.
Now, did you train in the dungeon?
I did. I actually, pretty much learned everything in the dungeon.
Wow. Who trained you?
Well, I had a medley of trainers. In a perfect world, when Natty is just being, you know, that Russian character Natalia from WWE, I would always say, you know, I basically give that patented answer, my grandfather, my uncle, but I had a bunch of people that were really a big part of my success. I had my family, my uncles Bruce and Ross, actually, they trained me in the basics. So my very first back bump, I learned that from my Uncle Bruce and my Uncle Ross. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the very, very basics, like running the rope, taking an arm drag, and, you know, all the basics.
Yeah.
But when I started to become more advanced and to grow, you know, and want to basically up my game, I started working with a Japanese coach that had never trained women before. He'd only ever trained males.
Was that Mr. Hito?
This is Tokyo Joe.
Oh, Tokyo Joe. Okay.
Tokyo Joe was one of my trainers, and he really changed everything about my style and about, like, so once I learned the basics, everything was, you know, like all the, you know, you learn that down in the dungeon where there's no give to the mat. You're just kind of doing it on board.
That's right. Yeah.
It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe really never trained a woman before, and he wasn't interested in training me at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just was only wanted to train males. And so Joe was, you know, did judo when he was younger, and he actually trained, Joe trained and worked with New Japan Pro Wrestling. So he was only, he trained like Tenzan and Makabe and all these stars in Japan.
Yeah, because guys used to come from Japan to Calgary to train not only with Tokyo Joe, but also kind of with Stu or whoever was available from the Heart World. But Tokyo Joe was sent from New Japan to live in Calgary and train the Japanese young boys and then send them back to Japan. Is that correct?
Right.
Joe,
you know, he had like a great relationship with my grandfather. He and my grandfather were very close.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started to express an interest about going to Japan, because, you know, after Calgary, I was like, well, I need to go and learn. I wanted to be the best I could because I knew I would always get to WWE. So I was like, how am I going to, I need to be amazing before I get to WWE. So I wanted to go and wrestle in Japan. So basically, my uncles had inquired if, you know, they wanted to see if Joe would help me. And Joe was kind of like, I don't train women, but because he loved my grandfather so much, you know, he let me train with him. And then we ended up building a really great relationship, and I trained with all the guys, and, you know, TJ Wilson, aka Tyson Kidd, and Harry Smith, and, you know, there's it was just a small group of us. And the occasional Teddy Hart visit would happen during our Tokyo Joe training.
Well, let me ask you this. How was it for you? I mean, obviously, you grew up in the business, and your dad, you know, was a very famous performer, your grandfather, your uncles. Well, how was it received when you first told somebody that you wanted to become a wrestler? And how old were you when you first decided that?
Well, it's funny because, like, I wasn't 6 years old and I was like, I want to be a lady wrestler, because back when I was growing up, there just wasn't, you know, there wasn't a Divas division. There was Sensational Sherry, and there was just managers.
Yeah.
That role hadn't really been defined.
Right.
And the women in Japan who I've grown to, like, love and, you know, that style and stuff, that was too obscure for me to know when I was a child. So it was really in my teens when, you know, I started building a relationship with TJ Wilson. And obviously my family, my cousins, you know, Harry was enthralled with wrestling since he was 8 years old. And we had that ring in our yard, and, you know, we'd always play in it. But, like, it was in my teens when I was like, I kind of want to, like, try this. And it was just sort of a curiosity thing that I was like, I want to, you're just kind of playing around. And all of a sudden you start to, like, I remember my Uncle Davey seeing me do a move with TJ and Harry. And he's like, oh, my gosh, like, that's great.
Mm.
He's like, Davey actually really encouraged me to continue.
This is Davey Boy Smith, British Bulldog.
Yeah, Davey Boy kind of was like, Nanny, you're really good. And I was, you know, getting some nice, praise from different family members. And Brett's always been, like, super supportive of me. I've always had a great relationship with Brett. But my dad was not supportive at first at all. And he was just like, and I couldn't understand, and I totally understand now why he wasn't, but back then I was like, I think I was 17 or 18, and I was just like so excited about finishing. I graduated high school a year early so I could wrestle more because I wanted to, like, go to Japan. And I went to this special school that was for athletes and basically expedited all my, you know, education so that I could get out and, like, basically go to Japan and work and learn my craft, because I knew I wanted to always be, like, I always wanted to get to WWE, but I knew I'd have to be great.
Right.
And so my dad was like, you can't go to Japan. You know, you're going to get your teeth knocked out there. I don't know why you want to do this, Maddie. It's too dangerous for you. Because my dad really felt like he just was more traditional. He just felt like he was afraid of me getting hurt.
Well, you know, just to interrupt quickly, I have two daughters, and I always think, like, what if my daughters grow up and want to be wrestlers? I would be so, like, mortified, because, like you said, I wouldn't want them to get hurt. And it's kind of it's a little bit of a chauvinistic view, because if my son wanted to get into it, I'd be like, yeah, go for it. But I guess maybe daddies are just more protective of their daughters, maybe. So I can understand where Jim was coming from with that.
My dad was so, like, and I remember, like, I just remember, like, I'm not going to talk to him about wrestling ever again, or talk to him about what I want, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because it's totally changed now, where my dad, like, as our role changed in WWE, like, we're not just wrestling in the ring anymore. We're
right.
Walking red carpets and hosting shows and doing interviews and talking and speaking, or ambassador. We're doing so much that my dad will, anything and everything I do in WWE, he's like my biggest cheerleader. And it doesn't matter what I'm doing, even if it's something that's small or like that, he's just like, Natty, that was great. You were so good. And, like, he's become a really good support system for me with it. But, you know, I think in my family too, it's, we have had a lot of ups and downs in the industry. And so, and that's, you know, I mean, it's just because everybody in our family is pretty much involved in it, whether they were married to a wrestler, whether they were a referee, whether they were in it themselves and they never made it, or they tried to promote, or they did make it and they were uber successful. We all have some sort of story.
Right.
So, you know, and that's, like, it's, I don't know, for me, I just couldn't really picture my life now without it, because I think I've lived, I've had such a rich life because of it. I've done things that I never would have, you know, been able to do.
Well, you're also the first female Hart, basically, I mean, Neidhart, but I mean, in the family, even though, like you mentioned, there were so many performers coming from your family, you were the first female. So, I mean, that's kind of, I mean, that's the first and pretty much only at this point.
Well, and that's, you know, basically because of the family, and, like, that's why I've always, the one struggle that I've really had internally with being a part of all of this is that when I first started, and I have a kind of a type A personality, I'm very much a perfectionist, I always want to just be perfect, and I look at my family, and I look at Brett and Owen and Davey, and you look at Dynamite, my dad, and Stu, and there's just such a legacy of excellence.
Yes.
And I always felt like I had to be perfect. If people saw me, if they saw Natty Neidhart, the first female, you know, representative of the Hart family, and she wasn't perfect, they'd think I was terrible, and they would, hate me, and they would, you know what I mean? And
it's
I
a lot of pressure.
So much pressure. And it would almost, when I first started wrestling, it really inhibited me. I remember my first tour of Japan, and I was, like, terrified. I was like, what if these people think I'm such a failure? Like, that's Bret Hart's niece, and she's awful. And so I put that pressure on myself, and I realized that, like, I'm not going to ever, nor should I ever want to be just like my just like Bret or Owen or my dad or Stu, because they're men.
Yeah.
Women are entirely different. I'm just blazing my own trail. And so once I kind of let that go and realized, you know what, I'm not them, and I don't want to be them. I need to be Natty. You know, and I see that too with girls like Charlotte Flair, Ashley Flair. She's down in NXT right now.
Yeah.
And Shaw Guerrero, you know, she's down at NXT right now. You know, Ashley Flair's dad is Ric Flair. And Shaw Guerrero, I mean, she's got to live up to the, you know, Eddie is one of
Eddie's her father, yeah. Eddie Guerrero's daughter, right.
And so, man, that's a ton of pressure. But when, and I talked to those girls about that, because all of us kind of feel like, you know, naturally we all do feel pressure. But when we talk about it, it's like, we're the ones putting the most pressure on ourselves.
I think it's, you know, there'd be pressure if you were a second or third generation wrestler if you were a guy, but it's even more so if you're a girl, because there's fewer jobs and there's fewer opportunities for female wrestlers. So of course there's going to be even more pressure on top of that.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think it's just, I don't know. I think it's good to have pressure sometimes, but as long as you channel it in the right way, and you know, it's it's good to be proud of your family, but like I don't live and die by my family. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I have my own identity, and sure, I love to post Instagram photos of, oh, Throwback Thursday, here's a picture of me and my dad growing up, or, you know, I'm so proud of my uncles, but at the same time, that's not my identity. That's not what defines me. I'm still my own individual.
Yeah, well, you had to make it on your own. It's great to have the last name of Hart, Neidhart, but you had to make your own way and do it yourself. Now, tell us about Japan. How did you get there in the first place, get the opportunity to go there, and how did you find it?
Well, that was through Tokyo Joe. Mm-hmm. So Tokyo Joe was like instrumental in that. And once I started training with him, and you know, he only, like I said, I was the only female that he had ever trained, and it was all just these Triple Crown champions that he was working with. And
right.
You know, he saw something in TJ, and he saw something in Harry. So he was kind of privately training them. And then I somehow, you know, like I said, because Joe liked Sue so much, he helped me. And then Joe, you know, wanted to kind of see his training kind of put to good use. So there wasn't a whole lot of work in Calgary other than working for my uncles, you know,
right.
For Stampede Wrestling or for, you know, a few small independent promotions around there. But Joe was like, I really want you to, like, get some consistent work. So Joe arranged for me to go to Japan through, you know, his connections and work with the women there. And basically, I would have to stay there for an extended period of time, which, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, first time out of the house sort of thing. Like, I wasn't a world traveler back then.
Right.
And so I had to be committed to living in Japan for several months at a time and not knowing anyone and just kind of like being thrown into, and I was excited about it, but I mean, I was so inexperienced with travel. We didn't have iPods or anything, but like,
yeah.
I just brought like one little carry-on suitcase, and you know, I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have any music to listen to while I was working out. It was like a couple books and a suitcase with workout clothes.
What year was that?
And it was 2005.
Okay.
When I first went there. So anyway, long story short, Joe was the reason why I went there. He set it up, and I basically worked and lived with these, you know, with the Japanese girls. And the year that I went, the very month that I went, All Japan Women's had shut down, and so did Gaia. That was April. And so, for some reason, these very famed, very successful women's promotions, you know, everybody knows All Japan Women,
yeah.
And then Gaia, they shut down the month that I came. So I ended up wrestling for the organization called NEO, Next Entertainment Organization, and a lot of the girls from those promotions came and worked with us.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a chance to work with Aja Kong and, you know, I'm just trying to think, Kyoko Inoue and...
Oh, wow. So some of the best Japanese women wrestlers of all time.
Yeah, Lioness Asuka, Mami Toyota. I mean, these women were like, I watched them, you know, basically because TJ and Harry were obsessed with anything and everything wrestling. So
right.
I had seen Mami Toyota's work, and I now all of a sudden she's on a show with me, going through a table. Like, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like this is insane. But yeah, it was through Joe, and that was really one of the best experiences of my life. I pretty much got paid nothing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I had nothing on me. I think I had like one old rundown sweatshirt from Zellers in Canada. There's Zellers.
Zellers. you know what's funny though, Nat, is you're mentioning some of these people or girls from, you know, Lioness Asuka and Manami Toyota, etc. In the 90s, when I was living in Japan, pretty much, they were not only the best women wrestlers in the world, they were better than a lot of the guys. And to the point where even in about 94 or 95, there was an actual Tokyo Dome show that was just for women wrestling. So there was like a whole 50, 60,000 promotion that was completely, the whole card was the women. So when you went to Japan, I mean, like you said, even though it was Neo, you still had some legendary performers to work with and I'm sure to learn from. Now, did they kick your ass too, though? Were they beating you up pretty bad?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because you bring the dungeon style, the style that I learned down in the dungeon, and then you bring, you know, you meet that with the Japanese style, and it was a pretty good.
You're pretty good, yeah.
I think both sides were dishing it out pretty good, but like, there was such a, my biggest fear working with the girls in Japan was just the fact that, that they didn't speak, their English wasn't, you know, there was a language barrier.
Right.
And then I realized that one of the greatest things about working with those girls was that we didn't need to speak the same language. Our language in the ring was wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
So that language spoke its own language. You know what I mean?
We'd
go in there and it was just like this mutual respect. And like, we would set up all of our own rings and there'd be like, we'd do shows on the fifth floor of a building and we'd have to go up, you know, elevators and things setting up all these boards and rings. And then after the ring was set up, we'd have to all get in the ring and clean it with little washcloths. And there was such a ritual and such a respect for the ring. That once you finally got in there, it was like, and then there was a whole other level of respect with, you know, with the girls that you were in there with. And yeah, they brought it, and I brought it, and they taught me about not giving up and kind of, as Tokyo Joe used to say, show me your guts. Yeah. Show me what you have. Are you going to roll over and die, or are you going to get up and fight?
Yeah, so the fighting spirit is something that the Japanese always love. And I noticed that too when my first tour there, I had just turned 20. And, you know, there was no calling the match, you know, talking about it. You would just go out in the ring and do it. And I realized, like you said, the language of wrestling. If someone throws you off the ropes, there's only so many things they can do. They're going to throw a clothesline, hit you with an elbow, backdrop you. I mean, that's pretty much it. And you don't really have to call that. But you just kind of learn to go with the flow with the Japanese people, Japanese guys and girls.
Yeah, you just kind of let your instincts kick in. And that's kind of what Tokyo Joe taught me is that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's very much like, yes, what we do in pro wrestling, you have to be extremely athletic, and it is a sport in my opinion, but we also are entertainers and performers.
Of course.
So you have to find the fine line and the balance of performing, but also using your instincts, because it's obviously, as we know, it's extremely dangerous. So when you can't speak the same language, you're not able to communicate, you have to kind of let your body, you know, surrender to the ring and, like, have a trust. It's a lot about trust. And so the girls there, everybody had such a high level of respect for each other that you would just, you know, it was everything. I felt like I had some of the best matches of my career with these girls that didn't speak English because we just respected each other so much and we used our instincts. And I felt like I was in the fight. I mean, there were some matches there, Chris, that I felt like I was scared to death.
Yeah.
I was literally going in for the fight of my life.
Yeah, it's like, this is a real deal. It's like a gladiator going to battle.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Were you the only foreign girl there, or was there anybody else from other countries?
No, there was just myself, and there was Sarah Del Rey, who's now a trainer at NXT.
Oh, okay.
She's one of the coaches, and she's really talented. She's actually, in my opinion, one of the best female wrestlers today, but now she's
a coach,
you know, yeah. She's a coach, which is awesome. And then there's also Amazing Kong. So that was, you know, now we know her as Karma. So she was there with me in 2005, and we had a match at Korakuen Hall.
So how many times did you go over to Japan?
I went over there twice, and I stayed over there for probably a combined 6 months.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was, you know, it was a great, the second time I went over there, though, it was kind of a, it was a good experience, but I tore my ACL when I was over there.
Oh.
So the first trip was awesome, and I wrestled pretty much every day and trained every day, and, you know, that was in 2005, that was pretty life-changing. But the second trip, it was before I got signed with WWE, and I was so excited about it, and then I was in a match And actually, I think I'm not going to bring up the names of people in the match, but no names or dates will be revealed.
Somebody messed up.
But yeah, something happened. We were practicing, practicing something, and I ended up blowing my knee out. I tore my ACL and meniscus, mm-hmm. but I didn't know that I was in such a, I'd never been injured before. So this is right before showtime, and I'm so excited. It's the first day of the tour.
Oh, wow.
And I'm in the main event of the show. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm so excited. And, anyway, super excited, blew my ACL out, heard the pop. It was like a gun going off, but I had no idea what had happened.
Right.
So I just got right back up, and everybody's like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, fine. I'm okay. Yeah, I think I hyperextended my knee. Hmm. And so I was really freaked out by it, but I was just also in a state of denial. And so I just brushed it off and pretended I was okay when I knew that I could barely stand on it, without it giving out on me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I finished the tour. There was like 12 more shows. Finished the rest of the...
Wow, so you worked the rest of the tour with a torn ACL and MCL?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Torn, not meniscus.
Torn meniscus.
So, torn ACL, completely severed, which actually was better, because I guess when your ACL is completely severed, it's not as painful, whereas when it's partially torn, it's
severed. Yeah, it's not as painful.
It was quite the experience, because every time I'd go to get shot off the rope, my knee would like pop out.
Wow. That's pretty tough that you finished that tour, I'll tell you that.
I didn't know what was wrong with me. So I was just thinking, maybe you just bang your knee up, or like I was in kind of a state. I was basically convincing myself mm-hmm. that I was totally fine. But I think that's what kind of was instilled in me in the dungeon and with Tokyo Joe. Like, don't ever show your pain.
That's right.
Don't ever show anybody weakness. Don't ever show that you're,
it's your hurt.
That stubborn yeah. nature that, like, what I learned from Joe and what I learned in the dungeon, what I learned from Japan, those were all the survival techniques that have kept me strong in WWE through all the ups and downs. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Just don't show your gut. Show your gut. Don't show any weakness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like you said, I mean, that's quite the I don't know if I could have done that. You're pretty tough, Natty. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, looking back on it now, I think I was just stupid.
We'll be back right after this with more from Natalia Neidhart. We're going to talk about her WWE experiences and WWE Total Divas, which has made her a superstar. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. Natalia Neidhart here with me, Natty. I'll always know you as Natty. So you finished up in Japan. You go to the WWE. Was that pretty much, how did you get signed into the WWE? Was that basically through Brett or through your name? Or did you have to go for an audition or tryout or something? Or how did that go?
Well, this is a story I love telling because there's a happy ending to it. I had been sending in tapes. I remember when I had my eighth match.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I've had eight matches. Like, I've got to send WWE footage.
Exactly.
By the way, Chris, these are matches where my Uncle Ross Hart designed the costume for me.
Oh, my God. What was the costume?
My Uncle Ross. Like, anybody that knows my Uncle Ross knows he's extremely conservative. He's like a principal.
Yeah.
he's just like, Natty, you must not show any boob, but you need those pants to be really long. Like, he's... I actually adore Ross. He's one of my favorite people, but he helped me design this costume, and he actually paid for my very first pair of wrestling boots, and they were from Stagecoach, which, still everybody
yes.
knows Stagecoach are really best.
That's top of the line.
Yeah, he got me my first pair of wrestling boots, my very first ring costume, but all of it was just like, the boots were cute. The outfit looked like I was trying to be, I wouldn't have put my worst enemy in the outfit that I had made. Of course, that's the initial outfit that everybody's like, if you Google, or go to Wikipedia, that's the freaking outfit that's on everything. So anyway, I kept on 3 years sending in pictures of me in that hideous outfit and thinking I looked cute. And, I had eight matches. Oh my gosh, I had this match in front of 20 people at,
Yes, in Strathmore.
In Strathmore, I've got to send WWE this stuff, and I put together this cute. Well, anyway, it was so amateur, and so it's actually really cute. It's like looking back, I'm like, God, Natty, I can't even believe you did that. But years and years and years of sending in tapes, and people sending me back letters saying thank you, but we're not interested, and just having the door kind of slammed in my face. I'd go to whenever they come to Calgary, and they'd go to the Saddle Dome. I would be, trying to get backstage, trying to get in the ring, trying to try out, and basically. I just kept on trying, and, mm-hmm. My Uncle Brett at that time, he hadn't really, things were softening up between his relationship with WWE and everything that had happened with him leaving the company. But it was still kind of like, you know, he hadn't fully mended all the fences. So I was thinking like, oh my gosh, is this okay for me to be here? I'm a heart. I don't know. Of course, I had, being a woman, overanalyzed everything and was like, daddy, nobody cares, really.
Right.
But yeah, I just had the door slammed in my face. I'd say 2002 is when I sent my first stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, cause I started, I think I had my first match 2001.
Okay.
And so, and that was with my uncle Bruce on his show, in Stampede Wrestling in Calgary. I think it was like 50 people in the crowd and I actually got low blowed by the referee.
Classic Bruce booking.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, again, one of those things that, looking back on it, I was like, man, Addy, what a ride. But finally ended up making some headway after I got cleared from my ACL injury.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up somebody in WWE, a very close friend of ours in WWE had helped, wasn't a close friend of mine. He knew Brett very well. Carl DeMarco.
Yeah.
He used to work with Brett. So Carl ended up I guess somehow arranging a tryout for us, for myself and TJ. And Carl was great. He kind of orchestrated us, at least getting down.
Helped you get in there.
Having the tryout. So,
Did you start in FCW in Tampa in the kind of the minor league, or did you go right to the main roster?
We started down in we had we had, I think, a couple months down at Deep South.
Okay, Deep South, right?
Deep South, and that was their developmental territory. And then Deep South ended up moving to Florida to be FCW, and
right.
Now it's moved to that was Tampa. Now it's moved to Orlando to be NXT. Mm-hmm. But so TJ and I, we started. We both got signed, and my tryout was an absolute, I don't even know how the heck I got signed from that tryout, because I ended up cutting my eye open during the tryout. It was like a Something About Mary type moment, when Ben Stiller gets himself caught in a zipper,
yeah.
And there's blood, and it's like they're getting ready for the prom, and he's going to have this date with Cameron Diaz, and
right.
It was like the perfect, I was like, I'm finally getting this moment. I had this brand new workout outfit. I was feeling so sporty. I just got my hair done and feeling like I'm going to show everybody how great I am. And
mm-hmm.
I go there, and of course, I don't even know what happened. I ended up having to get three stitches. I kept on wrestling in the tryout. I remember there was, I think it was the people that were at my tryout. I think it was Dave Taylor and Bill DeMott were there.
Yeah.
And so we're having this tryout match. And anyway, I'm bleeding from my face. And they're like, there's blood. There's blood. And they're rolling the tape, and I'm like, oh, my God, did I cut the girl that I'm working with? Did I actually hit her too hard? Is she bleeding? And they're like, Natty, you're bleeding. Your face is bleeding. And I was like, I just kept on going. And they're like, no, stop the match. You're bleeding. I guess it was a health issue.
Which is blood in the WWE nowadays is taboo. If you bleed, you must stop.
Well, and I didn't know that, so I just kept on ignoring everybody and just continuing to go. But it's such a surge of adrenaline because I was like, I'm in a WWE building. In a WWE ring, I can't, Natty, this is, now you got to show your guts, don't,
yes.
It was that mentality of just keep going, so I had blood streaming from my face, I had to go get stitches, and I was like, okay, great, that's your tryout, that's how it all went down, then the next day, they're like, you can't wrestle, because you got stitches in your face, and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do, and then everybody apparently thought my tryout was amazing.
Well, did you find it interesting when you first came in the WWE? I don't know if interesting is the word, maybe even difficult or frustrating or even hard, because it went through a phase in around the time when you came in when a lot of the girls were kind of just bikini models that were hired just because of the way they look, and wrestling ability was kind of secondary. And of course, you came in through the business the same way that I did, where wrestling ability was the most important thing, or at least very, very important part of the package. Was it strange when you first came up and you were around all the bikini models that didn't know how to take a hip toss? And meanwhile, you'd worked, a 3-week tour with a torn ACL and gutted your way through it. Was it a hard transition to get used to that?
What you're saying is very, true. As far as, that was one of the reasons why I had such a hard time getting hired,
mm-hmm.
is because I was trying to get hired during a time that was, during their non-PG era. Because I think they really went PG, I think 2007, 2008,
yes.
They really, really started going PG. But I was trying to get hired during a time that was very, the girls were pushing the envelope and everybody was a lot sexier. And I was just sort of more wholesome. I was Stu Hart's granddaughter, corn-fed.
Yeah.
Husky Jim Neidhart's daughter, looked like she had a few solid meals that day.
come on, your dad's Jim Neidhart.
Jim Neidhart, and that's, you know, I'm like a junior anvil or whatever. So trying to channel my inner Bret Hart, but really looking like Jim Neidhart. So, yeah, I mean, I ended up like getting caught between a tough time trying to get hired because I just wasn't that. I mean, Chris, the pictures that I was sending in, looking back on the stuff that I had sent into WWE, like trying to get hired, Chris, I wouldn't hire me.
With your Ross Hart, your Ross Hart approved ring gear wasn't cutting it?
My Ross Hart approved ring gear, the fact that I was like 180 pounds, I mean, I don't even know if I was 180 pounds, but I looked like King Kong Bundy's daughter.
Well, compared to the waifs that were there, like you said, the bikini models, I mean, you were a worker. If you were in Japan working, you had to be solid to be survived there in the first place.
But I think, like, I was just solid. I mean, I've always just been kind of a solid girl, so I've always been like that. I prided myself on what I knew in the ring and, like, the fact that, you know, my dad was a shot putter and a football player, and unfortunately I inherited his genetics, and so I was just naturally... Like, I just was different than everybody else.
Yeah,
so
but you're still a pretty girl, though, and let's not get carried away here.
Like, yeah,
you know.
No, and I, you know what, it's funny now, because looking back on it, it's really funny because all the things that I used to worry about, like, I'm not this, I'm not that.
Yes.
Like, I'm never going to get hired by WWE. I'm not, like, all those things now are what are making me successful today.
Uh-huh, because you're different.
Yeah, my little eccentricities, like, all those things, like, I remember when I was trying to get hired, I was like, I got to be... You know, I got to look like, and now it's like, no, we all look different, and that's what's making us all successful. That's why I'm part of Total Divas, because I'm so different than everybody else.
That's right.
And all the things that we were like, even when we do these, you know, WWE, I'm an ambassador for their Be a Star campaign, which is their anti-bullying stuff. All the things that I was teased about growing up or are the things that are making me super successful today. So that's kind of like, again, that's the moral in it, is that, you know, it's like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You know, what, everything's situational. What's in today or what's, you know, not in today might be in tomorrow. And, like, all the things that I, just by embracing Natty, by just totally embracing everything that I am and, you know, what my strengths are, that to me is, like, I don't know, I think it's my greatest asset. It's just embracing it and not hiding from it.
Well, absolutely. And you mentioned, you know, getting a chance in Total Divas, because I know, you know, in the WWE you'd worked a long time. You were the champion, the Divas champion. But then there was kind of a little bit of a lull career-wise, as is what happens to all of us. You kind of are on top, then you go to the, you know, you come to the back of the line. But then suddenly Total Divas comes around, and now you're like one of the most popular and most widely recognized divas on the roster. Did Total Divas totally like rejuvenate or maybe even save your career to a certain extent?
I think so, but I think, I mean, Chris, because you understand, because you've been part of, you know, the business for a really long time, and I think it's like, we all have those highs and lows. Anybody that's really successful in WWE or in you know...
In the business
in general, anybody that's really successful, from yourself to Bret to Shawn to Triple H to, you know, look at Vince. It's like there's highs and lows and ups and downs and peaks and valleys and, like, you know, and that's been the same for me. I think anybody that, like, has a passion for this goes through that. And, you know, like, I love hearing those stories about, you know, if you look at, you know... You hear, like, about Bret and where he's talking about, like, I didn't know if he was ever going to get past being Cowboy Bret Hart. And
right.
He was at his wit's end, and he was ready to throw the towel in. And, like, that's kind of what, you know, with Total Divas, it was like looking back on everything in my career in WWE and even before WWE, everything was leading to this gig.
Right.
That's how I look at it. And it's not like I'm calling Total Divas a gig, but every single thing, everything in my career, especially in WWE, it was all supposed to be that way so that I could get to be a part of Total Divas. Because on Total Divas, everybody can see that Natty is like kind of the ultimate underdog. But I don't think I would have ever been part of Total Divas if I had been revered and, you know, given the champ, you know, I had been crowned Divas champion five times over, and like, I wouldn't be the underdog. So
it's funny, when I first heard about the show and then saw the roster for it, and I was like, oh, this is brilliant. Like, the fact that Natty's on the show, you're going to be the star because you got the craziest personality and you're like really funny, quirky personality. How did you get approached to be a part of that?
Well, it's funny. I had just gotten back from Rwanda. We had done like a trip to the United Nations. So I went from a refugee camp to Monday Night Raw. And I remember basically being approached by WWE. It's funny because Triple H pulled me aside. And I was like thinking, did I do something at the refugee camp? I was like, my first initial anything, I guess, again, it's because I'm first of all, my heart. Secondly, I'm neurotic. Third, I'm a woman. So,
and fourth, you're in the wrestling business where anytime someone pulls you aside, your first initial reaction is, did I screw something up? Am I in trouble?
Right.
Do I have heat? Did I get heat?
So, that's exactly what I felt. Like, oh my God, did I do something at the refugee camp? So anyway, Triple H pulled me aside and basically kind of gave me like, you know, hey, we're doing this thing with E and this is going to be a great project and we would really love for you to be a part of it. And it's funny, like, I think a couple weeks ago I told Triple H, like, I really haven't, ever since he told me that news and gave me that news that I was being a part of the show, I still, Chris, haven't even digested all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I haven't even, like, I've been so excited. Like, from the minute he told me that, it was like, I felt like I was just on a different plane. And I was so, it just gave me this new spring to my step. And I was like, I'm going to, and I never, like, I remember, like, even 6 months into filming, because we've been filming for a long time.
Yeah, it's been almost a couple years, yeah.
Yeah, since last April we've been filming. And so I've been, everybody, once things get kind of settled in, everybody's like, oh, you know, we're part of the show. It never got old to me. Every time I tried to go into filming, like it was my first day. Remember how excited you were, Natty, when you, because I remember those low times when I wasn't doing anything and just begging to be included. And like, so I just had this great perspective on it. And the show has been so much fun because, you know, This isn't like a knock to anything in WWE, but because it's a 3-hour show on Raw, 2-hour show on SmackDown,
mm-hmm.
and there's sometimes there's only one Divas match.
That's
so,
right, yeah. Like, not a lot of places for the Divas on the shows.
Yeah, unless you're managing a guy or it's just challenging to kind of show. It was always challenging for me to kind of show my personality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been. Like all you can see sometimes is just Natty in the ring wrestling, so you couldn't see
for 2 minutes.
You know, yeah, so you can't, like, sometimes if you don't get that TV time, you're not involved in a story or whatever, it's hard for people to know what Natty's really all about other than the fact that she can wrestle and she can do the sharpshooter and she's blonde and she smiles really hard. And so this opportunity, usually the smiling really hard is me trying to cover up my, you know, the fact that I was bursting into tears an hour before, but,
yeah,
you know, usually some sort of family meltdown that was happening. But yeah, so, I mean, like I said, the reality show has given me a chance to kind of show people who I am and that, you know, I might not have a really wacky, crazy character on TV, but, like, you see my personality and you see that it's very, you know, you see the things that we go through and you see, you know, like I said, it's nice to be able to show the world that I'm not perfect. There's things on the show that people look back on, like, I'll walk into a grocery store, people are like, I'm sorry about what happened to your cat, or my husband's not romantic either, or... You really pee your pants in the ring? And I'm like, listen, that's the least of my problems. If you guys really knew what's like.
So, I mean, how is that? I mean, going from, because I remember when you first started filming, like you said, last April or whatever, the cameras are following you guys everywhere. And it's hard to even have a conversation with any of you guys because it's always getting filmed. How is that, you know, getting used to the cameras basically following you all over the place?
Well, you know what? At first, you're kind of like, it's weird because even like, It's just weird. You feel a little bit inhibited at first.
Yeah.
But then because they follow us around so much, that's kind of it's the fun and the dangerous part is that you forget that they're there. So then you start letting your hair down and letting loose and you'll mumble something under your breath or you'll just be human, you know, and then you'll watch the show back. And I was like, oh my God, did I actually say that about Eva? Or like, I hope Eva doesn't think that I remember we were driving in the car and Eva was talking to me about JoJo and saying she was just annoyed with her or something was going on and that Joe was following her around like a puppy dog or it was something, I can't remember, we were just venting, but we forgot that there were car cams on. And so I was venting about TJ and saying he was really getting on my nerves that day. And all of a sudden I was talking to Eva about like, I was like, you know, this business, like there's lots of people that try to get into our business, but not everybody is supposed to be here. I said, if everybody was supposed to be here, you'd have 50 girls running around from Hooters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big soundbite on one of the episodes. I got so many girls from Hooters tweeting me going, what's beef with Hooters? What are you?
I'll fight like, you.
Oh my God, I can't even go into Hooters now. People, I was thinking, no, that's not what. And then I looked at Eva and I was like, you didn't work at Hooters, did you? And she was, yeah, I did. And then I come to realize that pretty much every diva has worked at Hooters.
That's another thing. While you were tearing your ACL in Japan, they were serving wings at Hooters.
But, I mean, like I said, I realized, like, oh, man, Natty, you shouldn't have said that. That was kind of a rotten thing to say and very judgmental. But, again, it's, like, it's real. You know, you're kind of letting your hair down and, like, saying things you shouldn't. And they catch you in those they catch you in those moments that nobody, you don't even, like, how the heck,
yeah.
I don't even remember saying that, but it's because you forget that they're there, and that's kind of a danger.
TJ
gets very cheeky.
I was laughing when you've mentioned Tyson Kidd, TJ Wilson a few times. He's actually your husband. And you guys got married on Total Divas, and I was laughing. Classic heart. You guys waited until you got somebody to pay the bill before you got married.
Well, you know what, Chris? You know the Hart family way too well. I will tell you, though, that wedding was, like, that was so stressful. I'm almost thinking, like, man, it would have been
better.
That's why I didn't have a wedding before, because mm-hmm. of all those reasons.
Might have been better, like, just to do it at the community center in Lake Chapelle or something like that. In Calgary.
Do it at the community, the bone-ass community.
But, I mean, yeah, what an amazing wedding, almost like a storybook kind of a dream, and being on Divas is such a huge huge bonus for you.
Oh, it's really one of, like, the best experiences of my life, and it's got, you know, I never take it for granted. I always just, I'm so grateful, and I never would have had that experience if I wasn't in WWE. So all those things, like, about people saying, well, Natty isn't, you know, she should be doing more, she should be the Diva champion. Well, all those things were leading, all of my, like, my
right.
struggles have led me to this great moment with E! And with WWE, and, like, I would never have had it if I hadn't gone through something. So that, to me, like, it was all worth it, you know?
Well, absolutely. And Total Divas, you know, is a huge hit starting season 2 on March 16th on E!, but also, too, like I said, still you're still getting a chance to go and wrestle. And now with when you're out there, people know your personality a lot more. Thinking about all the years you've been in the business before I let you go, what's your favorite match you've ever had, if you had to choose one?
I think, I'm just trying to think, like, my absolute favorite. There's been a few that I've really loved.
Tell me a couple of them.
Well, one of them that was really special to me was the Divas table match. It was myself and Beth against, it was like the first ever Divas table
match
where we had this table that, you know, we were in this big feud with Lay Cool, and we were doing this, like, first ever WWE Divas table match where we were being allowed to put, like, whoever's the first to put somebody through a table wins.
That's right.
And Beth was just coming back from her injury, and she was my best friend, and, you know, we were partners, and I was Divas champion, and it was like everything had come to fruition. Like, I was, like, finally.
That was a huge spot on the show, too, like you said, first time ever.
It was such a special thing, and it was such a unique moment, and it's something that the girls didn't get to do, and we had painted the table pink, and we painted Michelle and Layla on it, you know, looking like witches, and it was just as carefully, like, the match was just, like, it was, like, a very high risk, and also elaborate, and, you know, dangerous,
mm-hmm.
and I just remember how surreal it all felt. You know, you're in a sold-out arena, it's this crazy match, I'm the Divas champion, the company finally, like, I'm getting to have this wonderful, special moment, and they're finally, like, putting their faith in me, and I was like, this is what I've wanted and dreamed of this whole time, and
yeah,
and it all went exactly how I envisioned it, like, almost like in a dream, and I, you know, Beth came to help me put Michelle and Layla through the table, but then they knocked Beth out of the ring, so then it was just me all by myself,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, I've got the two bad guys going after me, and I'm like, everybody thinks that Natty is doomed. And then I ended up pushing them through the table, but the table didn't break. Like, they're both so skinny that the table didn't, you know.
See, they should have been corn, if they were corn fed, yeah.
They weren't corn fed, like, you know, Stu Hart's granddaughter, as JR would say. But yeah, so, and I ended up pushing them through the table, but they didn't go through the table. So I ended up, like, no, anybody that knows me knows that I don't do anything off the top rope.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to, like, basically make a decision on the fly to go, like, okay, do I jump off the top rope to try to break this table and turn into, like, a flying squirrel? And I did. And it was just one of those moments where everybody in the crowd, like, stood up, and it was just really cool. Like, it was more, I don't know. And then, you know, obviously winning the Divas Championship, I mean, everybody would expect me to say that, but one of the matches that I loved, and I love winning the Divas Championship, but one of the matches that I really look back and, like, just loved was my match with Beth Phoenix. It was just magical, and I was trying to prove something to myself, and Beth was trying to prove something to herself, and it didn't matter what the outcome was. It was just this magical match with no
sure.
real build. It was just a story that was told that night in the ring, and, you know, that's what we do. We tell stories. Chris, you know, I love wrestling more than probably any other woman in the company, although I will tell you the Bella Twins have been extra feisty lately. They've been turning into Japanese lady wrestlers. But I love wrestling and moves and holds and submissions. But what I'm learning the most, especially from doing Total Divas, is that people will connect with you more with emotions. Well, and, you know,
it's always about emotion and personality, and that's why it's good that you got a chance to finally show off yours on Total Divas. Like we said, that starts March 16th, the second season. And Natty, it's great having you on the show. I requested you. I went had to go through all the hoops to get you on, so I'm really excited that it worked out. And it's very, very cool to get to talk to you.
Chris, I'm so happy that I got to be part of your show. And, you know, I think definitely have to do a follow-up interview where I can bring a couple of special guests, like Uncle Smith and the infamous Teddy Hart, and, you know, keep you updated on Teddy's Persian cat factory that he's got going on.
Yes. I need to have a Hart family panel show. I know the ratings will go through the roof.
And, you know, I would love to even bring Ronnie onto the show.
Oh, yes. Gap. All of the cast of characters in the Hart family pantheon would be here. Natty, thank you so much. It's so cool to talk to you, and congratulations on all your success.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris. Thank you so much. I appreciate everything.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thanks to Natty Neidhart. Always, she's a character. She's a true character, and you expect nothing less considering she is from the Hart family, one of the most eclectic, charismatic group of lunatics I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. Speaking of lunatics, did you go on the Twitter? At Talk is Jericho. Has the number to call in popped up? Because if it has, it's your turn. We're taking some calls here, answering some questions. And right away, we got Mike from Iowa is on the line. How you doing, Mike?
I'm pretty good, Chris.
What's going on, man?
I just had a question for you. I'm a huge Jericho-holic.
Thank you.
Back when you were in WCW, you were kind of overshadowed by the NWO. I was wondering how you came up with the most memorable promos from WCW.
The most memorable promo? Which one, in your opinion, is the most memorable promo?
Well, I was a big fan of Rufus. I love the Man of 1,004 holds.
Okay, so
like you were doing things that were just so different to what the NWO was doing that it just made it more memorable.
And I think that's the reason. And actually, it's funny. The funny name is it wasn't Rufus; it was Ralphus. Everyone thinks it was Rufus. Ralphus was a name of a character on this movie I used to watch called Bloodsucking Freaks, and he was like this little midget crazy freak that looked like a little John Oates from Hall & Oates, not to be confused with Oates's mustache, who's been on the show before. But yeah, Ralphus was a guy that he was driving the trucks around, and he had these really weird teeth he had no front teeth and just these spikes sticking out of the side of his mouth like walruses or something like that, like a walrus teeth. So I just decided that, you know, I needed to get this guy in the show, and I was doing this thing with Goldberg where Goldberg had like a big kind of a legion of bodyguards, and I thought, well, I'm so poor, I'm so, you know, such an idiot, I can only afford one bodyguard, so it would be Ralphus. So I cut his shirt in half and wrote Jericho Personal Security on it. I was doing things like that just for that reason, Mike, because there was nothing really going on for me there, so I was just trying to take advantage of anything I could to stand out as much as I could, because there really was no place for me there, and it was all about the NWO, and it was all about the promotion and push of those guys. So when you were a young guy in WCW, you just basically had to do whatever you could to get your head above water. And you know, I remember just going to the ring, and I'd ask Bischoff, "Hey, can I do a promo before my match?" He'd be like, "Yeah, just keep it short." And they had no idea what I was going to do or no idea what I was going to say. So it was just all kind of just doing anything I could to try and get noticed and try and get some kind of, you know, momentum going, and much to my surprise, it started to work.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so that's the story, man. So I appreciate your longtime fandom, and I appreciate you listening to Talk is Jericho.
Awesome, I appreciate the time.
All right, man.
All right, thanks.
Okay, next we got Sean here from Kansas City, lovely Kansas City. What's going on, man?
Hey, Chris, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. What's up?
I had a quick question here. I was on my lunch break from work.
Uh-huh.
I thought I would give a call in. So your angle with Goldberg, one of my favorite parts of your documentary is when you kind of go into details on that in regards to kind of the tension that occurred between you and him and Bischoff and trying to actually get that program to the point of a pay-per-view match.
Mm-hmm.
Before you guys ended up scrapping it, did you try to have any kind of intensive talks with them? I'm sure you did, in regards to that, and kind of what was the reaction?
Not really, and it's funny because the caller previous was asking me about kind of something we were talking about, Ralphus, and how Ralphus started was because it was kind of a knockoff on Goldberg's security. But basically what happened there is that Fall Brawl, I believe it was 97, maybe 98, I show up at the arena, and I was the TV champion at the time, and they said, you're going to be facing Goldberg. And I was like, oh, that's great, because he was doing his streak at the time. And he's like, no, you don't get it. It's a mini Goldberg, a fake Goldberg. And I'm like, well, why? And they're like, ah, it's just something fun to do in the pay-per-view. So they had kind of like a dwarf Goldberg come out, and you know, I beat him up, right, and you know, whatever, put him in the Walls of Jericho, and that was it. Next day, I see Goldberg in the airport, and he goes, I hope it was worth it, Jericho. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I hope it was worth it. Making fun of me. And I was like, well, I wasn't really making fun of you. First of all, I didn't book it. Just do it when I'm told, man. And second of all, it's like not really making fun of you. It's just kind of making fun of myself, really. So he was already kind of angry about it at the start, but I think because it worked so well, the office, or at least the bookers, Terry Taylor was booking, started doing, you know, I think I beat the little guy again, and I think I challenged Goldberg to a fight, and he never showed up because I knew he wasn't there. So I started keeping track of, you know, Jericho 3, Goldberg 0, and then, you know, went looking for Goldberg and knocking on his dressing room door, and it's like, you know, he's not in the building. I don't care. I want him now. Bring him out here. That would be Jericho 4, Goldberg 0. So it started kind of building up, and then Goldberg came out one night and speared another one of, I think I had Ralphus, who was Jericho personal security. I had the Jerichoholic Ninja, and then I had Viva Lost Jericho, three of them. And then Goldberg came out and beat up two of them, and me and Ralphus ran away. And then they started trying to get me to, you know, we're gonna pay this off, you're gonna work with Goldberg, and he's gonna beat you. I'm like, well, like everybody else? He's like, well, yeah, you're gonna lose in a minute to Goldberg. And I was kind of like, we've been doing this for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks now, and the people are really getting into it. They're bringing their own signs, and they're all excited about it. So I don't want to lose to Goldberg just like everybody else. I said, let's do it on a pay-per-view. That's all I wanted to do. And they wouldn't do it on a pay-per-view. They wouldn't give me that out. And I refused to lose to him like everybody else did, because we had built up this angle that I never asked for. Bill never asked for it, but guess what? It got over. And that's right. The thing. People wanted to see him kick my ass, and I thought that they would pay to see it. And so we actually were going to do it on a pay-per-view, and then Goldberg said no. He said, I'm going hunting that day, and didn't show up. So that's kind of how crazy it was in the WWE. But I never had any conversations with him about it, except for the fact that he was really mad about it and angry about it. And even at one point, I remember we were in Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. It was on my birthday of 1998, November 9th. And once again, they wanted Goldberg to beat me up. And I was like, no. And they sent Hogan in there to talk to me. Listen, brother, it was Hogan, Bischoff, and Goldberg yelling at me to put him over. And I was like, you guys don't get it. This will make money. And that's when Hogan kind of started understanding what I was saying. And then we ended up doing that day where I was in the ring kind of, you know, prodding Goldberg and antagonizing him. And then he came down the aisle and speared me in the aisleway, speared me about 15 feet down the aisleway, and then picked me up and threw me into the guardrail a couple times. And people were going nuts. And afterwards, Hogan said, listen, I get it. You stood up for what you believed in. You're right. This angle is worth money. We need to do this on pay-per-view. So if you can imagine that, lowly Jericho versus Bischoff, Hogan, and Goldberg in a dressing room saying, I'm not going to lose because it's not right. And that's kind of how it all started.
It just surprised me that there's nobody else from senior management or anybody else that had your back as far as in regards to the booking way it was done.
Yeah, well, nobody really did have my back. That's the thing. It was a crazy time. You know, it was a crazy time. Sure. It's hard to explain how WCW used to be, because it wasn't about making money a lot of times. It was just about personal choice and personal preference. So it was kind of a strange era. And to be honest, I never did lose to Goldberg in WCW, because we did that thing in Nassau Coliseum, and then he was supposed to work with me on the pay-per-view. And then, like I said, he never showed up. Ended up working Bobby Duncan Jr. instead.
Awesome. Well, sir, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I really enjoy the show.
Hey, man, I'm glad you listened. I appreciate that, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend. Keep on listening.
Sounds good, Chris. Thanks.
All right. Thanks to all of you for calling in, always, and for listening to Talk is Jericho, not just on Wednesday, but on Friday. Friday, Friday.
It's Friday.
And thanks for linking to Amazon.com through the Talk is Jericho page at podcastone.com. Remember, every time you do your shopping that way, Amazon kicks back a couple bucks, a little bit of moolah, some primo dinero to me and this show so I can keep bringing you the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll to you twice a week for free. I'm taking calls now. The long-distance bills are going through the roof, people. So, go to podcastone.com, find the Talk is Jericho page, and click on the Amazon link, and keep it on rocking. And thanks to all of you. We'll talk to you next week. We'll see you next week. We'll hear you next week. Peace and love. Stay hard. Stay cool. Stay heavy. This is Talk is Jericho. I am Chris Jericho. We'll see you soon. God bless you.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.